Welcome to the Physics 142 lecture for September 14th, 2010. I hope the format's working out okay. I'd like to remind you to email me if you have questions and or technical difficulties, and I'll see how I can help. At any rate, since I'm sitting in a room all by myself, I don't see any point to belabor this, and I'm just going to jump right on in. So, last time we talked about both Coulomb's law and the concept of the electric field. So just a quick reminder with Coulomb's law, if we are on page 1 for the accompanying PDF slides to this audio tape, let's look at Coulomb's law. And up at the top, near the number 1 with the Roman numeral 1, we're looking at Coulomb's law for a discrete charge. Sorry, I'm having to get my recorder settled here. So we're, up at the top of this slide, you can see the a big Q, and we want to ask what is the force of big Q on little q, and we saw that that force goes as kq big Q times little q over r squared along the r hat direction. So that would be the force on little q from big Q, basically discrete charge distribution. And we looked, if you have that would be a single discrete charge. If you have multiple discrete charges, then you basically do a vector sum of this quantity. So the more complicated case is if we go to a continuous distribution. So down at the bottom where I have the Roman numeral 2 circled, we have some arbitrary distribution, some potato of charge. We can't really deal with that. It could have a varying charge distribution. So what we do is we pick out a little differential, a little tiny dq of charge, because over that little volume of charge, that little dq, which is some rho dv, right? Some charge density times the volume. So it's a little differential volume. And over that little volume, because it's so tiny, we can assume that no matter what the charge density distribution happens to be, we can assume that it's constant over that little bit, and we can think of that as a little point charge. So we then can ask, we then can write down Coulomb's law for the force on the little green q off to the left of the sketch at the bottom left of page 1. And when we do that, we get the formula that is beside the Roman numeral 3 in the circle. So rather than saying F, we say differential F or DF, because the charge is a little differential charge Q. So it's not the total force of the charge distribution, but just the force of that one little dQ. So on the right-hand side of equation 3, we again write KQQ over R squared times R hat, but now I put it in the language for this particular problem. So the big Q becomes not just a big Q, but a little, but dQ, because that's the differential charge that we are is exerting the force on Q, little Q. Too many Qs in this mess. That's part of the joy of physics. We have to maintain lots of confusion in this mess. So then the trick is we have to get the total force on little Q. We have to sum up the effect of vectorially the dFs from all of the little different dQs. So you can imagine having infinite little expressions of dF, and basically we sum those up. And the limit that the number of dQs is infinite, we end up doing the integral. So at the bottom, the force on charge Q is the integral of the expression that we wrote in equation 3. But I have changed the dq into rho dv, because typically you aren't given information about, or typically the form of the information you have about how the charge changes is a spatial distribution. So you're given the charge density as a function of position. So that's what rho of vector r is in this equation. Rho times dv would be then dq for a particular little dv. So then the problem becomes, if you need to calculate Coulomb's law from some distribution, is actually doing the integral. And of course, this can be quite impossible, depending on the geometry of the thing, but to do analytically at least. But in many instances, the geometry is such that it's a doable integral. So let's now go to slide 2. For slide 2, I want to look at a very similar thing for both the discrete and continuous cases, but we're looking at the electric field. And remember that the electric field is the force per unit charge, as shown in the equation 3 on slide 2, the equation by the Roman numeral 3. So if we look at the top case for a discrete, we ask what is the electric field at point P. We imagine what's happening by placing a little positive test charge, which I have signified as pink Q, at the point, the blue P point. And we ask what is the force, and then we divide out the magnitude of that little test charge. So the force, of course, is kqq over r squared in the r hat direction. Divide out the little q, which is the magnitude of the test charge, and we get that the electric field at point P due to charge big Q is kq, where q is the big Q, over r squared in the r hat direction. And this actually is a very useful thing to just remember, because you're going to constantly be having to deal with knowing what the electric field is for a point charge. Then we go down to the continuous distribution by where I have a Roman numeral 2 in a circle. And again, I have some potato of charge, and dq is equal to some rho dv. And now it basically looks the same as what we did on page 1. And we ask, what is the electric field at blue point P due to the little dq? And that will give us a little differential electric field, and then we sum that up over all of the different dq's, and in the end we'll end up with an expression for the electric field, which is the integral over the whole distribution of k dq, but we'll write dq as rho dv over r squared in the r prime hat direction, because r prime hat, if you look at the sketch, is basically how I've defined the vector from dq over to p. So that is the general expression for the electric field, and again, just like what we have with the force, this is now very important, and it can be arbitrarily difficult depending on the geometry of the problem. It's also doable if the geometry is reasonable. So again, the integral is over the volume of the charge. All right. So now what I'd like to do is to look at a basic example that is like the continuous distribution that we have at the bottom of page 2. So let's pick a particular example with a particular geometry. So let's do something fairly simple. Let's go to page 3, and let's imagine that we have a charge distribution where a total amount of charge Q, big Q, is evenly distributed in a sphere, in a spherical shape. So if we go to equation 1 up at the top of page 3, rho as a function of a vector r prime, which is a vector in this case. Now, again, the notation may have changed a little bit here, so you have to look at this problem in particular. R prime in this case is a vector that goes from the origin to a little differential dq, which is somewhere at some arbitrary position inside the spherical distribution of charge which I have put in this problem. Rho represents a constant charge density in this particular problem. In other words, as we go out in radius or anywhere within the sphere, the charge density is the same. So in order to see what that charge density is, looking at equation 1, it would be the total charge Q in this sphere of charge divided by the volume of the sphere, which is 4/3 pi r0 cubed, because the sphere, I'm saying, has a radius of big R sub 0. And that's constant. Then the question is, if we are outside of this sphere, and so in the coordinate system that I've chosen in the problem, let's say we are at blue point P somewhere on the z-axis, so it's somewhere on the z-axis, and let's just say that it's at some point z such that the vector r goes from little dq all the way up to point P. The question is, what is the electric field at that point P due to this total charge distribution? And so now, to do this problem, we go to our general expression for an electric field. So that would be the green 2 in a circle. The electric field is equal to the integral over the charge distribution of k rho dv in the r hat direction over r squared. And of course, the direction for r hat is changing as we integrate around the charge distribution. So the little dq, remember, is moving all around this charge distribution as we add up all these little things during the integral. And that means that both the magnitude and direction of the r vector is changing. And so because it's changing, we have to do the integral here. All right, so this problem is clearly a spherically symmetric problem, and so the simplest thing to do in this case would be to integrate over the full volume, all the dq's, and we would have to do that in spherical polar coordinates. And I'm not actually sure if you guys have seen spherical polar coordinates. If you haven't, you're going to eventually have to get used to them. But in spherical polar coordinates, instead of using x, y, z, we have three different coordinates. One is, it's only good for spherically symmetric problems, or only useful for those anyway. One coordinate is the radius. One coordinate would be the angle. So let's consider the spherical polar coordinates for dq in this problem. It exists at some radius, which is the magnitude of r prime. And that vector forms an angle theta with the z-axis, and that vector forms an angle phi, which is projected onto the xy plane. And so the spherical polar coordinates are r, theta, and phi. And then we have to integrate over each of those, and it turns out that that theta goes from 0 to pi, phi goes from 0 to 2 pi, and r goes from 0 out to r0. And then we basically have to calculate the expression that we see in by Roman numeral 3. So I would like you to now go to slide 4. I hope that the discussion that we just had on slide 3 really bothers you, because it is nasty. And you guys aren't really up on spherical polar coordinates, probably. There are lots of little quantities in the bottom expression, the sine theta, d phi, dr. These are things that will make sense to you someday if they don't already. And we will play a little bit with them as the course goes on. But what I'm really trying to do here is to scare the bejesus out of you, okay? This is about as simple a volume of charge as you can imagine sitting outside of, right? It's just some spherically symmetric piece of charge. And if I want to calculate the electric field at some point outside of this charge distribution, it's ridiculous. I mean, look at the expression at the bottom of 3A. It's crazy. And so It can be quite nasty. In particular, it is really nasty if you have angular dependence. And it's not that we really avoid this type of problem. In fact, much of your junior level physics and part of your graduate careers, if you decide to go into physics, actually is spent dealing with these sorts of solutions that have angular dependence, because the real world is full of them. However, now isn't really the time, and this really is a mess. And there's a little thing that I have to tell you about physics, and I almost hate to admit it, but it is just oh so true. Fundamentally, physicists are lazy. We look at this crap on 3A, and nobody really wants to calculate this insofar as they can avoid it. So it turns out that there is a way to use symmetry of problems to avoid some of these awful calculations for the electric field. And that's what we're going to do next. So we're not going to complete this problem right now. I just want to leave you looking at 3A going, holy crap, this is really a tough problem, and I don't really feel like doing this, Professor Manley. And I say, fine. So what we're going to do is now look at a different way of doing it. So let's go to slide 4. Before we can actually start talking about this other technique, what I'd like to do is to build up a little bit of background. So we're going to talk about electric flux, and the word flux basically means it's the amount of stuff that goes through something. That's really the gist of it. And you can use, I believe it's a proper English word to use, and certainly it's used widely in physics that way. So let's imagine, look at sketch number 1, the Roman numeral 1. Let us imagine that we have a square flat surface area, which I'm calling A. And let's say that we have a constant electric field, the lines of which are the pink lines that you see going through here. And of course, the drawing isn't perfect, but imagine that these are evenly spaced and constant in space. And this electric field goes through the region of space that contains the area A, and that this electric field is perpendicular to the surface area A. In this case, the amount of electric field that goes through this thing, or a way to think about it, we call it, what we define as the electric flux, would be that total area times the magnitude of the electric field. And that's a measure of how much electric field, or the number, we say loosely, the number of electric field lines that basically penetrate through that particular surface. And we define that and call that the electric flux. So we can have a flux through any sort of surface, and the electric field can go through the surface in different directions. So we have to get a bit more complicated than that. Imagine that we now have, where I have sketched 2, Roman numeral 2, imagine that we have some arbitrarily shaped closed surface, and again I have some sort of arbitrary electric field that is passing through that direction that is not constant. So the pink lines represent the electric field, and you see them sort of the strength varying and direction varying all over the place. So in this case, we will have the electric field lines passing through the surface, and the surface you can imagine is being made up of little differential areas. What we'd like to do is quantify the flux of the electric field going through each of the differential areas. Now, the thing is, this little dA, it's a differential area, so it's small in cross-section. Because it's, small in area, because it's so small in area, even though this surface sort of has arbitrary curvature all over the place, because the differential area is so tiny, we can imagine that the differential area, the dA, is like a little flat piece of surface. Think of it as a little square piece of surface, and it's effectively flat, because even though the surface is curved, that little swatch is so small on that surface that it just looks flat. In the same sense that the yard of your house at home looks flat, maybe, depending on your yard, but you can imagine a piece of a golf course looks flat to you, even though it's actually a piece on a very big sphere of the Earth. So in that sense, dA is this little tiny piece. And then the issue is, these little dAs are all oriented in different ways, right? If you look at the three-dimensional orientation of a piece of a golf course in the United States, and the piece of a golf course in Germany, and a piece of a golf course in China, they all are actually oriented in different directions in 3D space. And we have to take that into account. So the way to do that is, if you look at Roman numeral 3 at the bottom right of page 4, we can imagine that dA is not just an area, it's not just a number like a scalar number that gives an area, gives the area, but it's actually a vector. And we can define the vector dA to be a vector that goes from the center of this little flat piece of area at 90 degrees outward, out of the closed surface, and it points out, and it's normal to the differential area. Now what would happen is if I change the orientation of this little dA area, I am also changing the direction of the vector dA. Another way to write this, which I show in by Roman numeral 4, the little sketch at the bottom right of page 4, we can imagine having a vector, which I'll call n-hat. So it's just a little normal vector to the surface dA, and n-hat is a vector that specifies the orientation of dA, just like in the sketch of number 3, as the little area dA changes its orientation in 3-space, the vector that is normal to it, the n-hat vector, will also change in its direction. N-hat is a unit vector that is always normal to the surface dA. In this case, we will say that the surface dA has a magnitude area of dA. So there are two different ways to specify this little surface, and you'll see it done both ways, and I'll alternate between the two very often. One is to think of it as a little vector differential area, and when you do that, the direction of that vector is normal to the surface, and the magnitude of it is the area of the dA. Or we can sort of break those two pieces apart, and you can think of having a little area dA, a scalar quantity, and it is associated with a vector n-hat, which defines the orientation of that little dA. Let's now go to slide 5. Okay, so you may want to bounce a little bit between slides 4 and 5, but the general expression for the flux going through a surface is, using the language we just had, is going to be the integral of E dot n hat times dA over the surface. Now, I need to make that make sense. The way to do this is to imagine, look at sketch number 2. Sorry, I don't have the right drawing here for doing this verbally. Okay, let's use our heads for a moment. Imagine having a sheet of notebook paper, okay, and hold it perpendicular to the ground. And let us imagine that we have electric field lines that are passing from left to right through that sheet of... So hold the sheet of paper perpendicular to the ground and perpendicular to your line of sight. And imagine having electric field lines that are going from left to right through that paper. In that case, what we have is a situation like what we have drawn on the top of page 4, which is the electric flux is going to be the area of the paper times the magnitude of that electric field. Okay? Now what I would like you to do is to take that piece of paper and rotate it clockwise relative to your point of view. So you're basically going to rotate it clockwise, and now imagine, so maybe rotate it clockwise about 30 degrees or something like that. In this case, imagine that the electric field, which is still moving from left to right, penetrates through the surface. But now, if you think about it, the projected piece of the surface that is projected onto the electric field lines is less. In other words, fewer electric field lines will now pass through the paper because they're going straight from left to right, and the projected area that they see now is less. If we turn the paper all the way so that it is now parallel to the ground, the electric field lines will not penetrate through the paper at all. Okay, they're going to totally miss it. So the amount of flux that passes through a given piece of surface depends on the relative orientation of the flux of the electric field lines and the surface itself. So if we now go on page 5 to where we have a green Roman numeral 2, we can look at some arbitrary situation where we have an angle between an electric field line and the normal to a surface. what we really would like to know is what is the component of the electric field that passes normal through the surface, right? It's only that component of the electric field that is perpendicular to the surface is the piece that passes through the surface. So that's what we want to project out. So if you look at the little sketch number two, then beneath it you can see that the component of the electric field that is going to pass, that is going to be parallel to n hat, is going to be the dot product of E dot n hat. So that will be E, the magnitude of E, times the magnitude of n hat, which is just 1, times the cosine of the angle. So what we really like to do, if we want to know how much of the electric field passes normally through a surface, where normal isn't lack of strangeness, but normal meaning at 90 degrees to the surface, then we want to sum up only that component of the electric field lines that are normal to the surface. And we can do that by taking the dot product of the electric field lines with n hat as we do the sum over the surface. So the total flux through a surface, equation 1, is given by the sum over all the little differential areas, so that would be an integral, of the electric field times the area, but only that electric field component which is passing perpendicular through the area. So we find that perpendicular component by doing E dot n hat, and then we multiply it by the area, which is a differential area dA. And then we do the integral over that. And of course, in doing the integral over the surface, if the surface changes in its direction and everything, then clearly the direction of n hat is going to change as we integrate around the pieces of the surface. And of course, the electric field might be changing. So this is a very general expression that is very important to remember. All right, if we look at slide 5 by the Roman numeral 3, we can rewrite, we use different notations for this. If we have a closed surface, then we can write it as we see up in equation 1, which is the integral of E dot n hat times dA. And in doing so, we put an S or a surf, for surface, down beneath the integral, which basically says you're going to integrate over this whole surface. There's a little shorthand that we use for that also, where we put a little circle in the middle of the integral. So on the right-hand side of Roman numeral 3 equation, we have also what's known as a surface integral, or an integral around the complete surface. So that's what that little circle means, of E dot n hat times dA. This also could be written as you see beneath that, which is E dot dA. Right? So now in this case I am taking the n hat times dA and making it the single vector dA. All of these are equivalent. So now we have a picture that you see below, which is what I want you to keep in mind, some arbitrary surface which has a little differential area. That little differential area has an n hat, and now you want to sum up all of these little differential areas as they are all around this particular surface. And as you do so, the direction of n hat and E will change, and you have to have the dot product within the integral in order to keep track of all that. Okay, so let's go to slide 5A. I designed and had an electric flux applet made for me, which is on the class website, which I think you'll find useful to allow you to play with electric flux. So if you will pull up that applet, it comes up, the electric field is not on. If you toggle the electric field on, you will see that the electric field is passing through, at normal incidence, a small rectangular square surface. And then you have the ability to actually change the angle of the surface, or rotating it clockwise, basically like we did with the paper in our minds a minute ago. And you can look at how the electric field lines are penetrating the surface, and as that angle changes, you can see that fewer electric field lines are penetrating the surface, and you can see how the dot product basically takes that into account. It projects out the piece of the electric field that penetrates the surface at normal incidence. So try different angles. Try certainly you want to try 90 degrees, 180 degrees. Notice that the dot product, if the electric field lines are penetrating through the surface in a direction opposite of in hat, and convention is if it's a closed surface, in hat is pointing outward. So if the electric field is pointing in to a closed surface, for example, you get the negative sign. So I do want you to change the angle so that the surface is turned all the way back around, and you can see that the flux is the same as it is initially, except for it has a negative sign. So play with this applet and enjoy it. I suppose if you want, you can pull it up on your computer and play with it at a party over the weekend, or not. Suit yourself. You don't want to do it too early in the party. Okay. Now let's go to slide 6. Let us suppose that we have an example where we have a charge Q, a point charge Q, and let us ask, what is the flux that goes through a surface, which is a spherical surface, at a radius of R0 centered at point charge Q? What is the flux through that surface? Well, remember our equation 1. Our general integral is, our general expression for the flux through the surface is an integral over the surface of E dot dA. dA can be thought of as n hat dA, if you wish. In this case, by the symmetry of the problem, the electric field at any point on the sphere must have the same magnitude, because every point on the sphere is the same distance away, and there is nothing to break that symmetry. So we can pull the other thing that we can see in this problem is, remember that by the symmetry of this problem, the electric field is always pointed out radially. This is a sphere, so n hat at all points on the spherical surface, for any differential area, n hat must be pointed out radially, because it has to be pointed out normal to the surface. So the electric field and dA, or n hat in this case, are in the same direction. So the dot product of E dot dA is just the magnitude of E times dA. The magnitude of E we can pull out of the integral in the middle of equation 1. So that pulls out, and we're left with nothing but the integral over the area of the spherical surface. Well, the integral over the area of the spherical surface is simply the area of the sphere. So we know what that is. It's 4 pi r0 squared. So the flux through the surface is equal to the magnitude of E times 4 pi r0 squared. We happen to know the magnitude of E, of course, so if you go to equation 2, what is the magnitude of E at some radius r0? It's kq over r0 squared. So we now have a total expression on the right, and equation 2 is that the flux through the surface is the total charge divided by epsilon naught, where I have rewritten k as 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught here. And this is one of the reasons we have that crazy k is also equal to 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, because if you look at it in this expression, if you have k equal to 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, it sort of simplifies it. This flux is just q over epsilon naught. All right, so let's go to page 7. So the net flux through a surface, let's go back to page 6. So one thing to notice is that the charge in this case is enclosed in the surface. So the field lines are all basically going from inside to outside through that surface. If you go to page 7, there is a theorem that I will not prove for you in this class, which is if I have a charge outside of a surface, the electric field lines, so imagine in the sketch, Roman numeral 1 on the top left-hand side of this slide, I have some arbitrarily shaped surface. Outside of that surface, I have a charge Q. And of course, the electric field lines for charge Q emanate from Q radially, and I have drawn three of them. Note that these pink electric field lines pass into the surface on one side and out of the surface on the other side. So when I'm doing a sum of the electric flux over this entire surface for one of those field lines, for example, on one side it contributes negative flux and on the other side it contributes positive flux, because on the one side it's going in into the surface against n hat and on the other side it's going with n hat, so the dot product flips sign. So I hope that you would find it very plausible to see that the flux lines, the electric field lines coming from Q, will contribute both negatively and positively as they penetrate into and then out of the surface. The theorem that I will not prove to you is that if we sum up the total flux on this surface, we will actually get a net flux of zero for any charge that is outside of that closed surface. That's a very important thing to keep in mind, and you can find proofs of it, or you will do that in, I guess, Physics 217 if you take it, but I'm not going to drag you through that mud here. So what that means is that the net flux through a surface is only the enclosed total charge divided by epsilon naught, as you see up in by Roman numeral 2. It doesn't matter whether that charge is some strange distribution, like I represent with the little blue Q as a function of R, or if it's discrete, like the Q1 or the Q2. It's the net flux that is enclosed in that surface, it is the net charge that is enclosed to that surface that actually contributes to the net flux. If it is negative charge, then the net flux is, if the total net charge inside that surface is negative, the flux will be negative. If the net charge inside that surface is positive, the total flux through that surface, the net flux will be positive. So let's pull all this together, and we have an equation 3, one of the core equations that we'll be using in electromagnetism, which is known as Gauss's law. It's very important, and it is true in general. Basically, it says that the flux through a surface, calculated by the expression we've seen, the integral of E dot dA over the whole surface, is equal to the total charge enclosed inside that surface divided by epsilon naught. This is known as Gauss's law. This is true in general, Gauss's law. It can be an arbitrarily hard thing to calculate. E dot dA could be very difficult if you have some arbitrary shaped surface and some arbitrarily changing electric field. This can be extremely difficult to do. Calculating the enclosed charge inside a surface can be arbitrarily difficult. That charge may vary as some weird function or something, and summing it up inside some arbitrarily shaped surface might be very difficult. So Gauss's law in and of itself does not make life easy for us. However, under certain conditions of symmetry, Gauss's law makes all the difference in the world for us. So let us go to slide 8. Let us take an example that may look rather familiar. Suppose we have a sphere of charge of radius big R sub 0 that is sitting at the center of a coordinate system, and let us look at what the electric field is at some point P. In fact, we can look at the electric field at any point P in this particular problem. Let us say that the spherical charge distribution is that the charge within this sums to total charge Q, and that it is distributed evenly such that the charge density in this particular problem is constant. And the question is, what is the electric field at point P? And in fact, let us ask also, what is the electric field everywhere in this problem? So this is the same problem that we faced a little while ago where we hit that really nasty integral. Okay, let us now look at this exact problem, but let us see if we can use Gauss's law to solve it. So first of all, what I'd like to do is to examine the symmetry of this problem and just get used to that word symmetry because we're going to be using it throughout this class. Let us look at the symmetry of the problem. If we were to consider a hypothetical surface, we will call that hypothetical surface a Gaussian surface. It is not a real surface in the problem. It is a pretend surface, okay? Let us pretend that there is a spherical surface which is at some arbitrary radius, little r. It is centered on the charge distribution. We select it to be a spherical surface so that it shares the same symmetry as the charge distribution. And what I would like to do is to evaluate Gauss's law on that arbitrary surface. In this case, the surface is not at a completely arbitrary, it's not an arbitrary surface at all. It is a surface that shares the symmetry of the charge distribution. Also, the radius, which I have labeled as little orange r in the drawing, is not completely arbitrary. Let us first consider little r, where little r is bigger than r0. That is, we are going to consider a Gaussian surface that is spherical in this problem, which exists outside of the sphere of charge. So the radius of the Gaussian surface is bigger than the radius of the charge distribution. Then what I would like to do is to evaluate Gauss's law. So let us look at equation 1, and that is, of course, Gauss's law. The total flux is the integral of E dot dA over the surface, and we know from Gauss's law that that has to be equal to the total charge enclosed over epsilon naught. Well, on the Gaussian surface, because it's a sphere, there's nothing to break the symmetry of the problem, so therefore the electric field of the charge distribution must be pointing out radially, because there's nothing to give it any sort of angular dependence. So by symmetry of the problem, it points out radially. And the electric field magnitude must be the same everywhere on the Gaussian surface. Again, why? Well, because there's nothing to break the symmetry. The charge distribution is at the same distance away from the Gaussian surface everywhere throughout, and there's nothing to break the symmetry. So the electric field by symmetry of the problem must be of the same magnitude and pointing out radially along the Gaussian surface. Well, that means we can evaluate Gauss's law. First of all, we have picked a Gaussian surface where all of the charge in the charge distribution is enclosed. Therefore, the right-hand side of the Gaussian surface, the right-hand side of Gauss's law, just becomes the total charge Q, but that's the total charge enclosed, over epsilon naught. The left-hand side, because E and dA are in the same direction, E dot dA becomes the magnitude of E times the magnitude of dA. The magnitude of E pulls out of the integral, as I show at for equation 2, the left-hand side, and then we have the magnitude of E times the integral of dA. What is the integral of dA for a spherical surface? That is just what is the surface area of the spherical surface, which we know to be 4 pi r squared. What r do we use there? Remember that it is the radius of the Gaussian surface we're considering, so it will be the magnitude of E times 4 pi little r squared is equal to Q total over epsilon naught. So that gives us equation 3. If we solve for the electric field, it will be Q total over epsilon naught and divided by the 4 pi r squared, which I pull from the left-hand side. And the r is the little r for the Gaussian surface radius. So what we have now, if you look at it, is an expression for the magnitude of the electric field at any point, any radius, little r, outside of big r0. We have just calculated the magnitude of the electric field anywhere in the universe outside of this charge distribution, including point P. It points, we know that it points outward in the radial direction if total charge Q is positive, and inward in the radial direction if total charge Q is negative. And it falls off as 1 over r squared. And it depends on the magnitude of the total charge as to how strong it is. So you can see this is vastly easier than what we did with when we were trying to set up the electric field calculation earlier using the brute force method. In this case, we've taken advantage of the symmetry and what Gauss's law provides us, and we have solved relatively easily for the electric field everywhere outside of the spherical charge distribution. That's all right. You can smile. This is actually very cool. Okay, this is very neat, and why Gauss's law is so important. So now let's go to slide 9. We have yet to calculate the electric field everywhere, so to do that we have to consider the regions of space inside the spherical charge distribution. So the first step to doing that is to choose a position, or let us hypothesize the existence of a Gaussian surface that shares the symmetry of the problem. So we want to consider a hypothetical Gaussian surface that is spherically symmetric in this problem and is centered on the origin of the charge distribution. And in this case, it will have a radius which is arbitrary except for the fact that it is less than R0. Big R0. So we want to choose the little radius of the Gaussian surface, little orange R, to be less than R0 in this case. Gauss's law holds, so equation 1 holds. That is always true. By the symmetry of the problem, even though we have charge inside and outside the Gaussian surface now, there is nothing to break the spherical symmetry of the problem, and it means that the electric field is going to be along the radial line, so it is going to be parallel to n hat, which means the dot product becomes simple. The other thing that we have is, because it's a spherically symmetric charge distribution, no angular dependence in this thing, there is nothing to break the symmetry, therefore the electric field has the same magnitude everywhere around this Gaussian surface. So that means that the integral of E dot dA again becomes the integral of E times dA, where the vector pieces are now gone. The dot product, remember, in a dot product, you take two vectors, one vector dotted into another, and you get a scalar with no vector, right? And so E dot dA in this case becomes E times dA, and the magnitude of E, because it is constant as we do an integral around the surface, can just pull out of the integral. So we have equation 2, that the left-hand side of Gauss's law becomes the magnitude of E times the integral of dA. Well, we know what the integral of dA is. It is 4 pi little r squared again, and that is equal to the total charge Q enclosed over epsilon naught. Whoa, what is Q enclosed? Q enclosed is not the total charge enclosed inside of big R0 in this case. It is the total charge enclosed inside our hypothetical Gaussian surface, because we are evaluating Gauss's law on that Gaussian surface. So, in this problem, the hard part is to evaluate how much charge is inside that little Gaussian surface. So in equation 3, the left-hand side of Gauss's law becomes the magnitude of E times 4 pi little r squared, and the right-hand side becomes the integral of rho dV over the Gaussian surface. So that is calculating how much charge, the integral of rho dV over the volume inside the Gaussian surface. And this is inside the Gaussian surface, not the total charge distribution, divided by epsilon naught. Well, in this case, the integral of rho dV is easy because rho is a constant. Rho is just the total charge Q in the charge distribution divided by the total volume of the charge distribution. So that's going to be total charge Q divided by 4/3 pi big R0 cubed, right? So that's rho, and that's a constant, times 1 over epsilon naught. Now we have an integral, so on the right-hand side of equation 3, we have an integral where everything in it is constant, and we can pull it all out. So we end up with Q total of 4/3 pi r cubed times epsilon naught, all that in the denominator. except for the two-toe, in equation 4, times the integral of dv over that small sphere of radius, the lar. What is the integral of all the differential volumes for a small sphere of radius, the lar? That is just the volume of the sphere, which is 4/3 pi little r cubed. So that takes us to the top of page 10, and I pull all these pieces together for the Gaussian surface, the piece we're doing, which is the Gaussian surface inside of big R0. So the left-hand side of Gauss's law becomes the magnitude of E times 4 pi R squared. The right-hand side of Gauss's law becomes Q tot over the quantity 4/3 pi R0 cubed times epsilon naught in the denominator times the volume of the little sphere, which is 4/3 pi little r cubed. Now I solve for the magnitude of E for any radius r less than R0. It's going to be Q tot times little r over 4 pi R0 cubed times epsilon naught. That's basically a constant times little r. So if I were now to plot the electric field magnitude as a function of radius inside the sphere, that is, for little r less than big R0, we have an electric field that is growing linearly in r. And then once we reach R0, we go to the other solution where it falls off as R squared. And we now, and it is radial in both cases. And whenever you do these problems, you really need to specify the direction. If I ask for the electric field, you can't just give me the magnitude. You'll have to also give me the direction. So in this case, we have now solved for the electric field in all space, which is very cool. So Gauss's law is arbitrarily nasty for an arbitrary problem, but for a problem that has a proper symmetry that we can, where for problems of certain symmetry, the calculation of the left and right hand side of Gauss's law can become relatively straightforward and can allow us to solve for the magnitude of the electric field at any point. And generally the symmetry will determine the direction of the electric field at that point. The types of symmetries where it is particularly useful are problems with cylindrical symmetry or spherical symmetry or planar symmetry. What determines that it's useful is that the dot product needs to be, the symmetry has to be such that the electric field dotted into dA is either E times dA or zero. So the electric field has to be either along the surface pieces, along the normal to the surface, or perpendicular to it. The other thing is that the electric field needs to be constant on the surface, and these are the two things that really allow you to simplify the left-hand side of Gauss's equation. And then the right-hand side is basically you have to know how much charge is enclosed in that surface, and that depends on how the charge is distributed, and generally, of course, that can be quite difficult, but in general we'll choose the distribution of the charges such that it's doable with at least an integral, maybe by inspection, depending on what it is. So those are the times when Gauss's law is very useful. Gauss's law is particularly wonderful because it allows us to calculate the electric field under certain conditions of symmetry. And you may think that's just a phenomenal limitation. But the truth is, look at these symmetries. Wires have cylindrical symmetry. No matter what your problem is, if you have a long wire, you can calculate it with Gauss's law, basically, if you consider a small enough region near that wire because it has cylindrical symmetry. Planar symmetry, spherical symmetry, and cylindrical symmetry, you can build a lot of things with that. And here's the thing. you can have a fairly complex problem. If you can break it down into pieces that have symmetries that you can use, remember that the electric field is a vector field and superposition holds, which means I can calculate the electric field of the total as the vectorial sum of the electric field of the pieces. So I can have a pretty complicated shape, and if I can sort of break it into things with spherical, planar, and cylindrical symmetry, I can actually get at the total electric field for that system. And so even though Gauss's law seems severely constrained, it turns out to actually be fairly useful in a lot of the thinking. And I believe that that is the thought that I will leave you with today. Thank you for your time, and have a good day or evening, whichever is relevant for you as you listen to this. Bye.